Welcome to What Is It About the Weather? I'm your host, Mark Jelinek, and this is the weekly podcast where we explore all things weather-related while really not talking about the current weather. This week, we're going to be talking about, did weather give us Mario Kart? But before we jump into the main topic, let me just say, I hope you've had an enjoyable, intertwined weather week. You know, I always say this, so much of my life is kind of constantly weather intertwined, and so I'm always looking for the little interesting kind of maybe unique tidbits. Things are a little different. Not, oh, Mark issued a weather forecast this week, or, oh, Mark wrote some code that put weather graphics up on the internet, or whatever it might be. It's kind of fun. We're back to our Did Weather Change History series. You know, we try to do these about once a quarter. And we did our first one actually a year ago, not exactly today, but right around the time of D-Day, and that was the first one we did. But one of the things I really enjoy about this is usually when I'm doing an episode or preparing for an episode on this sort of topic, I'm looking at one or two ideas. You know, I may have an idea of what I think the episode I want to do, this current one is, either through a suggestion, you know, from somebody that sent it in or something I've seen. But I'm always trying to think of some new ones. And particularly this time around, there were a couple things that hit me. So I was looking at one and, you know, some ideas for South America because we haven't traveled down there yet. And I really do hope to, you know, do kind of an episode down there. And I have a couple ideas after looking through this. So I was looking through that and reminded of that. The other thing that just happened kind of by chance is I was watching a series about the Appalachian Mountains, the Great Smoky Mountains on the southern end of the Appalachians, and, you know, the weather element there. Now, the show was not about the weather per se, but you know my mind, I always get in the weather and started reading about the Smoky Mountains and the kind of the standing fog issues and some of the things that give it its name. Now, I don't think that's, you know, a what is it, you know, did weather change history thing. I actually did look, you know, could weather have helped the people that created moonshine hide where they were making the moonshine? And, you know, it may have played a role, but it certainly wasn't a big role. But there's my mind at work. And yeah, again, I enjoy looking at those sort of elements. And as we get into today, we'll talk about more. I mean, this is a great learning experience, hopefully for you guys, but also for me as well, because a lot of these topics are things that, you know, I've just never even looked at or thought about. I also had one of those weeks. It was a bit of a soapbox week. There were a couple things that really just lit my fire. And you know what? I really don't like this podcast to become burdened with that sort of material. And you can follow me in other places if you want to see me post on it, or you can send me an email and talk to me about it. I'm glad to do that in any, you know, any of the ways you can reach out to me. But there's some that I need to follow up with the involved parties first. I guess the older, wiser Mark is trying to not be so quick off the handle with things and let it absorb, let it soak in. But I've just seen a lot of hypocrisy this week. We'll leave it at that and move on. The other thing that was interesting this week is I got a couple of responses from people. Now, as I've mentioned before, for instance, even with the last week's accessibility episode, I tend to send off messages to some subject matter experts when I'm doing these things. Sometimes I try to do it well in advance when I'm doing the episode. But given that this is, you know, kind of a one-man dog and pony show and I'm putting this stuff together, I tend to do a lot of the, what I would call the in-depth investigations on whatever the topic is within the last 2 weeks before I'm doing the episode. You know, I may have done some exploratory things, but my mind doesn't get around it until a couple weeks before I do the episode. So quite often, I'm reaching out to subject matter experts probably too late in the game. But it was interesting that I heard back from somebody about the accessibility, and I also heard back from the person that I'd sent an email to when I was talking about weather alerts, and I had sent something off to somebody who had mentioned, specifically on a podcast, that, you know, they had 4 weather apps for something that they did in another country, right? And I got some great feedback from both of those people. And I will cover that. I'm not going to talk about it today. I'll cover it in a future episode. But it's just a reminder that, you know, again, I always laughed at these things. Literally, one of them came in 2 hours after I recorded the episode last week, and it was pertinent information. I kind of alluded to it in the episode already, so I don't think it's a big deal. And I think the gist was already there, but it is always funny to me that these things sort of happen. So these were my non-weather kind of components this week. I've certainly got a lot of weather going on around me like you do, but let's jump into the main story for this week. Now, I put it out there, did weather give us Mario Karts? Mario Karts, however you want to say it. I've heard it said both ways. Tomatoes, tomatoes. But really, you could take Mario Karts and insert any kind of iconic Japanese brand that you're familiar with. Did weather give us Honda or Toyota or Lexus or Nissan? Did it give us the Canon camera that I've been using over the past year? Did it give us the pachinko machine? Oh, I love pachinko machines. It's one of those things from my youth. Did it give us Sony Pictures? You know, I use PlayStation View and part of my cutting the cord process. And I'm not a place. Originally, the title I thought about was, did it give us the PS4? You know, very modern sort of thing. Or Nintendo, like I said. Any of these brands that we've all come to know around the world. Is weather responsible? So let's talk about the episode in time that may have been a key moment that allowed Japan to move forward and become how we know it today. Now, there were certainly some elements around World War II, and many of us know this, and I'm not going to do another, you know, we did D-Day, and actually I haven't found a weather-specific thing, and I'm sure there might have been a weather-related event in the Pacific elements. But I wanted to go a little further back in time to a period that was suggested and what might have happened weather-wise that could have been in just an incredible part of the process. And really determine was weather involved. Now, many people who are familiar with World War II know the term kamikaze. And I apologize in advance to my Japanese listeners because I know I'm going to say all these words with a Southern American pronunciation, the ones I grew up with. And while I try to correct them, I'm sure I'm not saying them right, so I apologize in advance. But the word kamikaze actually comes from a different period in time, and it translates into divine winds. Okay. So were the idea is, were the saviors of Japan, as we know it today, these divine winds? And again, we got to take that modern context just completely out of the picture and think back to where the actual winds may have originated, where these stories came from. So let's set the stage a little bit, right? It's the mid-1200s. We're in the Dark Ages in Europe, you know, in between the kind of the Roman Empire and, you know, during in the Renaissance Age. So it's not exactly a bright time in that part of the globe. And something very different is happening in Asia. The Mongolian Empire was on its way to becoming the largest continuous land empire ever. Now, in terms of total land area, you know, the estimates are that the British Empire at its peak was larger. But the British Empire, as you know, was built around this idea of naval-based expansion, whereas the Mongolian Empire was over land, most of it. And if look at a map, and I'm going to put some different links in the show notes, and I think one of them has a good map, but you don't, you know, this is the kind of thing that you can just Google, you know, largest empires ever, and you'll see a map. And it's impressive, and we always forget about it. You know, typically, I live over here in the U.S., and or even if you live in Japan, you know, these two land areas relative to some of the others on the earth are small. But if you look at the size of the expanse of the Mongolian Empire, it's impressive in how hard it was to move in those days over land. It was easy in some ways, right? It was easier to get from point A to point B than maybe getting in a boat. But in terms of vast movement, it was so much easier to do it in a boat then. And even today, when we're going large distances by land, so often we fly there. Certainly, you know, in some areas, train is still prominent, but none of that existed then. So if you think about that in this context, it's just a huge, huge empire. Now, it was being led at the time in question by Kublai Khan, who was the grandson of the famous Genghis Khan. He was looking at, how do I continue to grow the empire? And particularly, he focused on two things. One was China and his dominant role over the area that we know as China today. And that was a focus. But in the region as well, he looked to a lot of other areas. And I'll call them by today's names. Not all of them had these same names. Whether it was the Korean Peninsula, excuse me, whether it was Vietnam, or whether it was Japan. Now, anybody who spent any time, and I'm not an expert in that region, just knows that, you know, we're talking about some very different terrains that go on here. I mean, China aside, I mean, the difference between Korea and Vietnam, and I grew up, you know, knowing the conflicts that were going on there, and I knew they were in the same region, and I thought of them as being very similar, but they're drastically different. And of course, I've learned this through my meteorological life, how different these regions are, you know, versus being something more tropical, for, you know, completely being almost near the Arctic Circle in differences here, and that's drastically different. And I just didn't have that concept growing up. But Japan kind of sits in the middle. It's a large island, and that's where part of the context comes in. It's not like it's a single island. There's multiple islands, and there's a main islands. But there's also some large, smaller islands that make up what we know of as Japan. So in his effort to kind of control the region, Japan was in his eyes. You know, this is somewhere I need to control. Now, at the same time, in Japan, we were coming out of an age where royalty or fiefdoms were a little more important in a pure sense, and military was coming to become prominent. Now, the samurai warriors had been around for a while, but they were going from being more private hired or supporting the diplomat who owned the land or was in control to a setup where they were in charge. And it would, during this time, it's referred to kind of as Japan's medieval age. And you know, so this was going on not all that differently, a little later than the medieval age in Europe. But within the context, you had this rise, like I said, of more military-oriented thinking. And this would eventually lead to the shogun or shogunate control in Japan, which would last for a couple hundred, few hundred years, depending on whose history you read. But the idea was pretty simple in that, you know, these people who had kind of been worker bees in a bee colony idea rose to become the power. It had a centralized power, and that's part of what changed, is they went from little regional private armies to a consolidated army. The shogun was the top military officer, but the shogunate is kind of this controlling body, and it was different clans still involved. No matter how you looked at it, it's the best way I know to equate it is kind of like the states here in the United States for those, or any region where you tend to have regional powers, right? You can look at Europe today and say, even though you have this unified Europe, there's these individual countries and they each have different ideas and they each bring different things to the table. And it was no different in Japan. So the shogunate was this governing body, but it was made up of warriors. Okay, plain and simple. This was not something that, you know, was elected officials or anything like that. But the other thing that I was reminded when I was investigating this was the pace of all these things. So Kublai Khan sent off a diplomat and said, you know, basically, bow down to me or there will be consequences. Yes, I'm paraphrasing, but we'll keep it simple here. but it would be years before he would act on it. And I'm just reminded in this kind of Twitter, you know, life on the moment sort of age in which we live in, how different things were in these time frames. And that was a reminder of it. So let's set up the two cases that are in question, right? Because there's really two different events that took place that are relevant here. The first happened in 1274. Kublai Khan sent, so he was in control of Korea at this point and much of China, or what, you know, we know as modern day China. So collectively, troops from this would go off this area that was kind of the closest land on the Asian continent to Japan. But, you know, you still have a gap in there. We're not talking a couple miles. We're talking, you know, let's say 100 miles, just to put things in context. I guess it is. This was going to be a contest as well. So you have that element going on. And the first, like I said, the first of these was one that, you know, I would almost call it the hopeful idea, thinking that Japan didn't have the defense capabilities. All right. And that is true. At that point in time, Japan, you know, relatively population wise, was much smaller than what was going on in the mainland. And was a little distributed, still in these kind of fiefdoms and clans sort of kind of set up. But here he was sending this force. And, it, you know, again, one of the challenges I have with all these is different history is going to have different sources as to what, you know, how many it was. But let's say it was on the order of 40,000 or so troops and just shy of what seems to be on the order of and less than 1,000 ships, 800, 900, 700, 900, somewhere in that range. Let's not get lost in the detail. And they were going to what's referred to as the Korean Strait. They were leaving the mainland and going over to Japan. And there are a couple of introductory islands in that area that they would go to first. So they went and did this thing. And essentially, you know, they were winning, going along, doing their thing, making their way towards the mainland. And then, all of a sudden, a typhoon. Now, it's not quite this simple. It was interesting in this case. So basically, they got to the mainland. Japan kind of knew it was coming. They went out there, and they were just outmatched for the style of fighting at the time. They weren't prepared for how the battles were going to go down, the weaponry available to the Mongols that the Japanese didn't have, you know, generally speaking. So they kind of retreated inland. The Mongols didn't follow them because they didn't have enough intelligence about the land, and they figured, you know, I'm in no hurry. I've got time. Well, who would have known, right? A major storm comes through, or as the story goes, a major storm comes through and blows them out of the water. Now, essentially, it did enough damage to allow the Japanese to kind of do some counterattacks, and that would be enough to say, hey, you know what? Let's not be in a hurry. Maybe we don't have enough people. Retreat. Let's go back. Let's rethink this whole process. And they did. And then 7 years later, that's, I get these timescales, 7 years later, it wasn't like they went and regrouped and came right back. You know, the idea was maybe they rushed it. Need some more troops. Need some more ships. So they put together a much bigger force next time around. Much, you know, again, nuances, differences here in estimates, but much closer to around 4,000 ships with nearly 150,000 warriors. Now, none of them were more than that. They were probably closer. They averaged around 125,000 to 140,000 warriors. It's still pretty impressive. Significantly larger than the first invasion. But at the same time, the Japanese had time to prepare. They had put seawalls in place, defenses in place that allowed them better fighting positions. However, the belief is they were still well outnumbered. All right, no matter how you sliced it, in terms of the available troops, I'm not saying in terms of total population or anything like that. I'm just saying in terms of the troops available to fight the battle. So this wall they built and the fortifications they built kind of kept all these ships in this harbor. And again, a typhoon would come through and do major damage to these ships that they had employed a technique apparently where one of the challenges they had the first time around is the Japanese were able to quickly get out to the boats, and I don't know if you've ever seen like orca whales go after like a baby whale, and what they try to do is they try to separate that baby whale from the family, right? Because the big whales can protect the baby whale, but if they can isolate it, the results can be drastically different. Well, the Japanese were able to do that in the first invasion that I mentioned previously, but in the second one, the combined ships of, again, keep in mind, these are Korean ships, these are Chinese ships, in terms of different styles, different types of construction, but they kind of bound themselves together in a way that would allow people from one ship to get to another to help in the defense process, particularly with some of the larger ships. But all this thing meant that they were kind of anchored together in the harbor. This typhoon blows through and decimates a good number of the ships. And again, the Japanese were then able to go out and strike down additional ships because this fortification plan that had been put together was then taken apart. And generally speaking, there were a couple things that came into play. The belief is that some of the ships, particularly the smaller ships, were really not ocean going or ready for a typhoon. They were more what you would think of as a ship that might go up a river or much calmer waters. But again, the divine winds, the kamikaze winds, were believed to play a role. And ultimately, and again in this case, would lead to the Mongol-led invasion having to retreat. And while there would be attempts in the future, none of them were as large as that. And Japan was more easily to hold them off. And quite frankly, after that, while there would be different skirmishes in the region, there's no doubt, none of them were to that scale. And this would allow Japan to develop essentially as a standalone power in that region for hundreds of years. So there's no doubt that these invasions were kind of the attempt to bring Japan under control of a different entity and could have shaped that. But even if they had been more successful and had kept Japan in conflict for decades or centuries, it could have drastically changed how Japan was able to evolve as a culture. That is not undisputed. The question we have is, was weather really the critical element? Now, I found a couple of pieces of new research. One of them was an article, and I don't know, this was suggested by one of our listeners and supporters, Jack. And I don't know if he had seen these articles or if he'd been familiar with them previously, but there's been some new things written. One was a book that came out in about 2010, and there have been some others around this, that hypothesized whether there were storms or not that Japan could have, with their skills and their abilities at the time, especially how they evolved between the first event and the second event, could have withstood it and still won. And that's real easy to say, because that's a lot of coulda, woulda, coulda. sort of things. And maybe that's true. Maybe it's true. I can't answer that. We will never be able to answer that. The real question is, in that day, what was the difference? So there's this book that proposed, and there are a couple things I saw written on it, that it was more the skill in the end of the day that was the difference. And then there was some new research, a new research paper that came out in 2014, I think, that dug a little bit more into the typhoons and did some interesting core samples to talk about, were they real? And that's what we've got to get to, is the reality of things. So as we all know, history gets exaggerated, right? These tales of conquest, King Arthur, we got a new King Arthur Excalibur movie out. Different empires, they're always telling the story in a favorable light or what they want to tell. So the question would be, what's the motivation behind exaggerating the typhoons? It was clear there were storms of some kind, but would it be more useful to exaggerate that the powers at hand were able to call up divine winds? Certainly, you can imagine that. Or on the flip side, you could argue that they wanted to show that while we have divine capability, us mere mortals could defeat you, right? So you can imagine different ways, different reasons that different people might want to represent the history in a different way. Now, as we've already talked about, what's really not in question was how this allowed then Japan a period of growth that may not have been experienced. And all those brands we talked about today that we know of may not exist. I'm not saying that we wouldn't have evolved as a, you know, a global society and had a lot of the same things, but these brands, this way of thinking, this approach to how they went about it and still go about it today may not have existed had Japan not been able to move forward in the way they did. And you could also argue the consequences of World War II have had an impact as well. And they have. I mean, I'm not going to deny any of those things. Those were all pieces of it. But Japan is a world power at the time that World War II took place. May have led to very different outcomes in that region and where things stand today. But let's get back to this. Was weather key? Now, I've talked about how some people propose and the study proposes, and that's one of the interesting things, is some people don't understand that that's a region where people were questioning not so much whether there were storms, they were questioning the magnitude or how powerful these typhoons could have been in that region at the time. And that's part of what the research was trying to show was, we go through periods where stronger or weaker storms go through regions, or you know, climates changed over, you know, we talk about ice ages and the little ice age or the medieval warming period. All these things have played roles in time. And the idea was, could this have been a period when we saw really powerful typhoons in the region in question? And what the research showed was, yes, it's very, very feasible that these could have been very powerful typhoons. So at the end of the day, the question is, which was more to play? And I don't know that, you know, that, or that's the way they've been trying to answer it. I think the question really is, was weather a critical factor? Was it one of the key elements in deciding in both of these invasions that the reason that Japan was successful and holding off the invasions was because of weather? And the evidence I've seen is most definitely, yes. I have to say with what I've read that weather definitely changed history here. All right. Hope you've enjoyed that dig into a little bit of 13th century. I guess that's, I always go backwards or forwards. I think it's 13th century. 1200s, right? 1200 history in Eastern Asia. It's interesting, and again, I'll put a couple links in the show notes. It's kind of fun stuff to read, and I recommend that you take a look at it. All right, we're in meteorological summer now, folks, and I put a little post on the Facebook page, what is about the weather Facebook page today, that, you know, this Weather Ready Nation ambassador thing that I'm doing now, summer safety. Remember that summer, so many of the summer things that can hurt you or damage you that you'll experience much later in life are things you just don't think about because they're not these visually striking things like flooding waters or lightning. Yes, that stuff's going on, but the heat, the sun, just keep it in mind. Water, sunscreen. If you think about two other things this summer, those two things, please keep those two things in mind. All right, next week is the 50th episode. Yes, I know numbering is always one of these things. And yes, we've done more episodes. If you think about the You Ask, We Answer, and a couple of what I did, those brief shows where I was taking a few weeks off once a quarter like I was doing back then. But in terms of the numbered episodes, 50. So we're going to do the Ask What Is It About the Weather episode, I think, next week. I'm going to try to. If you have any final questions, don't hesitate to let me know. All right. Also, a couple of you will have noticed that I've launched a new thing called Woe Forecast. I'm gonna do this thing. It's a little fun. And we've done a first one, and it's been figured. It's a little bit of where on earth forecast. Now, two things going in mind. I'm going to issue a real forecast. verifiable forecast, and I will follow up on whether I did good forecast. But the idea is it's partly about the forecast, but the forecast can give you an idea of where it's being issued for. And I'm going to Google or some photo from somewhere. Sometimes it may be a large area. Sometimes it may be a very pinpointed area, but the goal is to try to figure out where on earth it is. So I'm going to post those on the new page I started for the Facebook page that I did for What Is It About the Weather. You may see me post in other places like my personal stuff or on the Twitter feed or those sort of things. But the idea is to, I don't know, hopefully have some interaction. It's been a little tricky. The first one, I posted a couple locations and it's kind of hard to consolidate that. But we'll see. I'm just giving it a try. Something fun to do, something different. All right. Time to wrap up here and let you guys go. In the summer season, and I already noticed it with the trends and how downloads work around our Memorial Day here in the U.S., summer is one of those strange times. Downloads tend to be down generally, but I also find that's a good time to do the sharing and interaction. So let's talk about the support for a minute. You know the way we talk about it here, RSVP, rate, share, validate, and pledge. And you can learn more about that at whatisitabouttheweather.com/support. But think about different ways during this season when you got maybe a few extra minutes. I know you're rushing off on vacation. When you get on vacation, maybe you're listening to an episode. Take a few minutes. Do a review on iTunes. Tell somebody walking by you on the beach, hey, have you heard this podcast? It's really cool. Whatever it is, appreciate it. And actually, I'll call out to Jack in this one because Jack not only sent the idea for this episode, but as I mentioned before, he's supported us on via PayPal, which is one of the ways you can actually support it. And that, you know, I've been for a few episodes now using the new microphone holder / pop filter thing. And hopefully you've noticed a difference. I've noticed a difference in the quality of the recording. And it's through those, no matter how big or small, donations that we're able to keep a quality podcast going here. So thank you to Jack specifically in this case, but to all of you who support us both financially and through the other methods and the RSVP approach. Now, if you want to reach out to me, you know how to do it. Just pop an email, right? It's real simple. Or go to the form. So email, whatisitabouttheweather@gmail.com. Pretty straightforward, right? Or the contact form. whatisitabouttheweather.com/contact. Just pop a little form there. Either way, that's part of the validate thing. Let me know questions, feedback, thoughts, ideas. And again, you can ask me a question about an episode. I always try to get back to people, at least initially, and I think most people will test this, the day that I hear from people, if I can, you know, at least to say, got your email or got your request. And then a lot of times I'll follow up more detail. I love the interaction. I love the opportunity to communicate with you guys. And again, that can be on the Facebook page and via Twitter as well. So as you enter your summer season, and I know my folks in the Southern Hemisphere, you're going into winter. For those in the summer, may you have an enjoyable summer with all that can bring in terms of your time off with family and friends. Be safe out there. For those entering winter, may your winter be enjoyable in whatever way you find winter enjoyable. And just remember that spring will be just around the corner for you guys. So until next time, let's all keep in mind, there's much more to weather than the weather itself.
We're tired of hearing our uncle grovel, so please support him on patreon.com/weather.
This is Two Words Super Production.